Coming up on today's episode, NASA's 2021 budget proposal looks interesting. Tesla is making their own batteries in-house. And SpaceX hires one of NASA's most renowned employees. Let's get ludicrous. Hello and welcome to Our Ludicrous Future. This is the podcast where we talk about all the crazy stuff in the world that's going to make our lives totally ludicrous. I'm Joe Scott from, I'm Tim Dodd from Everyday Answers with Tim, and with us is Ben Sullins.
Oh man, botched it. See, Joe's gone for one day and we just completely fall apart. What's up everyone? This is Ben Sullins from Teslanomics, and all of us are traveling today, so quick apologies if you it sounds a little bit different than normal. And Joe, as you heard, is not here with us, so gonna be flying a little light today. But we've got tons of good news. And hello to everyone in Patreon on Discord that's listening live.
Hi guys,
how are you guys doing? Give us a thumbs up. Make sure you can hear us.
Sweet, they're there. Hi guys. Yeah, there's this is one of those weeks where there wasn't a lot of, for me, like it's a lot of like a news week. It wasn't like a, you know, a mission heavy week or like a hardware heavy week. It's just a lot of news coming out for me this week. What about on your end of things?
There's this, it's kind of light. There were some big ones, but you know, the Tesla stuff is all, it's kind of like, I think we're all waiting for Model Y is where we're
right
at. I think basically
right
we're in a lull of Tesla news. There were a couple things. And we could dive into those, but I think you have a lot of space stuff if you want to kick it off.
We'll do two space things that are kind of related-ish, and then we'll go into, and then we'll switch. We'll kind of just flippity-flop, keep people on their feet, right?
Let's do it.
So let's start off with some, this is just, there's a lot to just unpack here. So I'm going to talk about the 2021 presidential budget request. And of course, our friends at the Planetary Society at planetary.org, they do a really good job of making a nice little chart for us here to run down. Keep going, Ben. There you go. This is the fiscal year 2021 presidential budget request. And of course, this isn't necessarily what NASA's actually going to get. It still has to be approved by Congress. But this still, you know, you typically can take this and this will give you a good sense of, you know, the direction of which the administration and of where NASA will likely be heading. So when we look at this, 2020 enacted overall budget for NASA was $22 billion, $629 million. And the presidential request is going up to $25 billion, $246 million. That's a 12% increase in overall budget funding for NASA, which is, of course, in my opinion, a really good thing. I'd much rather see 12% increase in NASA's budget than a 12% increase in, say, military budget. For me personally, I know everyone's got their own thoughts on things, but here's where things get interesting. Unfortunately, the science would be reduced by 12%.
What does that even mean? I feel like everything they do is science.
Well, you're not wrong. I'm pretty sure, like, when it's just overall science, it's like literally, you know, when NASA is doing a research paper or something on, say, how CO2 interacts on Mars or something with something. Like, that is a purely scientific NASA science budget. And there's a lot of science. You know, think about all of the little things that are, like, you know, literally just research at NASA. That's actually, although science is kind of the whole, it's the overall topic of all of these things. So I can actually tell you exactly what those are, but in general, it's kind of like, you're right. It's like basically the bulk of what NASA really does is science.
It looks like this is kind of the breakdown here where
there's planetary science, earth science, astrophysics, WFIRST, which is an upcoming mission proposal, James Webb Space Telescope, and heliophysics. So yeah, that's the breakdown of like all of the science.
So the biggest hit was astrophysics, it looks like, and WFIRST is just dead.
Canceled.
According to this, yeah.
Yeah, so WFIRST was a really cool, I believe it's an infrared telescope that I believe it was a leftover NRO satellite that basically got donated to NASA. And, you know, then basically like, hey, retrofit it, turn it into a really high almost like a Hubble Jr. But it'd be able to do things that Hubble can't do. was a really exciting mission. And considering that a bulk of the actual hardware was donated, it's really, really a shame to see this go. Like, that's just one of those, really?
You're going to let go of that? $511 million is, looks like what 2020 enacted was for that.
Yep. And so, now just full-blown cut. And here's the thing. I don't know if that'll pass. I'm guessing that that'll have a lot of backlash because it's... Right. It will have a lot of, I think a lot of people at NASA will, I don't really know how that works exactly, but I'm pretty sure people will be like, no, 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 this one's really cool. Yeah. James Webb Space Telescope surprisingly actually got a will get a decrease under this proposal of only 2%. But yeah, in general, like you can, like I said, especially the, you know, the earth sciences take a pretty big hit, and astrophysics, like, I don't know, it just seems like, why would you not want NASA studying astrophysics? You
well,
know?
It definitely seems like, I mean, yeah, I guess not knowing the details of how all of these pieces interact with each other. Like if you want to, I don't know, launch something out to Mars, astrophysics is probably something you should like be spending money on, right? Because there's a lot of what happens with those things that you need to understand in order to do that. So,
although I think a lot of it's really advanced astrophysics, you know, like way beyond generally simple orbital mechanics, like
beyond
that.
Anything practical.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Practical for now, like really, really advanced, like black hole,
sure,
you know, type of stuff. Like the cool stuff, though, that is, it's important. But here's where things get more interesting. This is more my side of things. This is the exploration is seeing a massive 46% budget increase proposal. Now, surprisingly, you'd think NASA budget increase, you'd really think, what's the first thing you think of when you think of NASA and a vehicle?
Space shuttle.
Come on, Ben. That was 9 years ago.
Well, you mean in general or like right
now? Nowadays. Now.
Oh. Well, yeah, it's the new moon missions, right?
And what vehicle? I'm putting this on you. What vehicle is the one that NASA's been developing this whole time?
The SLS.
Exactly. So you'd think if a NASA budget increase of 46%, you'd think SLS would get an increase too. Nope. SLS would actually get a decrease, and so would the Orion crew vehicles. Kind of shocking to me under this proposal, mostly because the SLS would no longer be developing the upgraded upper stage, the Block 2 upper stage, and basically this proposal would be like, nope, just start producing SLS vehicles. We're just going to throw Orion on top of it, and you're going to be good to go. Like we're just going to use Orion basically as a way to get a big, heavy Orion capsule out to the moon safely, get our astronauts up there, no problem. Because the big increase, you'll see two big increases. One, for Lunar Gateway, of 64% increase. And Lunar Gateway is basically the rectilinear orbit platform that would just go back and forth between Earth and the Moon. And you can think of it as like a reusable command module. So you could launch a smaller, kind of like a smaller command module, put crew on board a bigger thing. So if they're up there for weeks, they actually have some accommodations and more room for science and activities. And it also would be, you know, steerable, so you could change orbits and change your destination to the moon. It's actually a pretty cool system. The more I get to know it, the more I am somewhat in favor of it. But the biggest increase, 462% budget increase for a lunar lander. And that's what it's going to take. Like, that's, you need that if you're anywhere talking about landing humans on the moon in 2024. Like, there needs to be hardware built and tested and being seriously proposed, you know, even if this all goes through, imagining a company truly building a lunar lander and having it ready to land on the moon in time seems ridiculous, you know, if by 2024, but at least maybe even like by 2024 with traditional stuff, I could see, you know, something landing uncrewed by 2024 and getting humans on the moon soon thereafter. I think that'd be pretty cool.
Isn't it just, it still is, you know, mind-blowing. It was like 50 years ago that we did this. And now we're still like, I don't know, maybe 5-6 years from now, we'll like, maybe, you know, we got to put in $10 billion. It's like, it seems a little bit ridiculous, but.
Well, we definitely don't do things as willy-nilly as we used to, you know.
Yeah.
We definitely take a lot more thought and consideration.
So looking at this budget, so the 2020 number here is $600 million. And the proposed is $3.3 billion.
Billion, yep.
How, like, what did we spend $600 million on already?
Well, for this year,
it's just
year,
a concept at this point, right? Is well, nothing's actually yes, been built,
but,
right?
But this year, you know, for 2020, a lot of money actually got awarded to a bunch of different companies. You know, Boeing, Lockheed Martin. Boeing kind of had their own plan. Lockheed Martin did that joint venture lander concept. Blue Moon has a full thing, and so it got money sent out to actually start developing hardware and really coming up with real proposals. So it's kind of this. The cool thing is that the lunar lander's portion will be very commercialized, and it'll be very, you know, this company versus that company. So the first bit of that funding, although it seems kind of, you know, it seems like a lot of money, could save a ton of money in the long run, because you end up with companies really putting their best foot forward, putting together really aggressive proposals and really wanting to win these contracts. So, you know, you're actually putting them against each other. And yeah, that's kind of what the $600 million has done so far, is given those companies room to actually develop and build their...
To go do something.
Go do stuff, yep. So we'll see that this year. We'll see more and more concrete plans actually laid out this year for the people that won that first round of funding. So that's pretty cool. Space exploration technology went up 43%, space operations up 1%, aeronautics 4.5%, STEM engagement 0%, minus 100%. It dropped down to 0%. So there would be no more government funded STEM engagement programs.
That sucks. Like, I mean, you're talking about schools and stuff, right? Like kids.
I'm pretty sure it's just like full blown materials for schools and
million,
things like that.
I feel like 120 million could go a long way. For
it goes a long way in a school, and it's almost nothing in your budget.
Right, like when you think about it, what's an elementary, like how many kids are in, say, a third grade class or something, and how much does it take to have materials and stuff, like, I don't know, $1,000 or something?
Right.
You know, a couple thousand bucks tops, and then do that across every school in the nation? Like,
right.
That to me, that sucks. Like, that's a bummer. For
it
sure.
does. And the lunar lander getting $3.37 billion, if you took $120 million from there, you wouldn't even notice.
Yeah, it's still a huge jump. $3.2 billion.
Right.
You know?
Right. So that's a bummer. But safety, security, mission services goes up 3.3%. Construction and environmental compliance up 45%. That's good, just because there's a lot of infrastructure at NASA, especially down at Kennedy Space Center, that's just fading away. It's rusting away. There's a lot of construction. I would like to see stuff revamped. And they've been doing a good job, actually, compared to the past, like, 5 years when I come out to NASA. You know, our 2014 was the first time I was almost right at a hotel right next door here, basically, in Cocoa Beach. It was the first time I really came down here. And, man, it was derelict at that time. And some of those buildings are more derelict, but other of them have been revamped and actually getting new blood, so...
So what happens when you build stuff by the ocean, man. I mean, it just...
It's true.
They got to stop doing that. Start launching from Kansas or something. I don't
know. No one cares about St. Louis, right?
Right, yeah.
If it lands. But now I'm going to have people be like, St. Louis isn't in Kansas. I'll be like, well, guess what? The trajectory, if you launch from Kansas, flies over St. Louis. Suckers.
Yeah. We care about Kansas. We don't care about St. Louis. That's the summation here.
Except for City Museum. Got to keep City Museum. That's
the greatest
place in the world.
That's right. That's
keep that place. Okay, so anyway, then the NASA Inspector General up 6%. That's a good thing. We want oversight in a lot of these things. So speaking of oversight, I'm going to pop in. I'm going to break the order here.
Uh-oh.
So there's been a lot more reports about Boeing's software error with their Starliner capsule. And Eric Berger from Ars Technica just had a little write-up here, but I'm pretty much just going to tell you. I listened in on the phone call, the press conference. So as you know, in December, there is a test flight of Starliner. We've talked about this over and over and over again. And right before we recorded last week, they already had a thing coming out saying there's some kind of other software glitch. I wanted to talk about it because I actually kind of really understood it after listening to the press conference more and really getting a sense of what that software bug was. So... let's pull up, Ben, can you pull up a picture of Starliner with its trunk capsule? Maybe just do a Google search. I could do Starliner Everyday Astronaut. I've got a picture on my website that has it with its service module attached. Because here's what we're going to do. So basically, NASA, and look for images, and you'll probably find it. I think. Let's see here. Yeah, this development cost one. Click on that. That's a good representation.
Which one?
Any of them. That one or the one below it.
Got it.
For those of you listening, Ben is pulling up a big old fat picture that has, you know, all of the crewed spacecraft that has visited the ISS that I had in my Starliner versus Dragon capsule video. And it keeps scrolling down, Ben. I don't know. I hate how Google now does this. Like, they don't let you just, like, embiggenate an image really easily anymore. They, like, hide it off to the side. Mm-hmm. Somewhere we'll see a picture of Starliner. Right here. Perfect. Perfect. Okay, so Ben has a picture pulled up of the crew module and its service module. So, as you know, in December, you know, it went up. It had a clock error that made it think it was, like, 11 hours ahead of where it actually was in the mission, making it fire its thrusters all willy-nilly, and then that made it so they were not able to actually go to the International Space Station. So they, you know, had about 2 days, and they were running through their systems, making sure that nothing else was going to go wrong, making sure they caught all the software errors. And literally 2 hours before this operation happened, they realized that there was another software bug that made it so when they jettisoned this trunk, the bottom portion here, so the trunk has the radiators, the solar panel, most of the extra propellant, you know, for the abort system, for the actual propellant to get to the ISS, a lot of the, I mean, it's a big chunk of the spacecraft. Before you re-enter, you actually have to get rid of that so that the heat shield on the crew module is there, right? Yep, and that's the bottom part. So they jettison the actual trunk there, the service module. That is supposed to, like, burn, like, fly off on its own, so it burns up on reentry and gets really far away from the crew module, right? And therefore, the crew module has the, you know, safety of the heat shield and all these things. The problem is they realized that when those two detach, the service module actually has its own guidance and navigation and literally would fly itself away. Like, mm-hmm. you know, it's supposed to use its thrusters and fly away from the crew module. Well, they realized that the mapping between the two units was messed up, and the thruster mapping. So basically, after they disconnected, it was still going to have the same thruster mapping as when they were connected.
Mm.
So that means what happens when you have a big spacecraft like that, and those two things are connected. If you are to say pitch over on one thing, some of the thrusters on the bottom are doing almost what you would think they wouldn't do, just to keep it so it's only pitching. Because otherwise, if you hit one thruster, it might also, you know, drift off into space. So in order to only pitch, you have to fire other thrusters in, like, the opposite direction to do things. And those thrusters are on the, you know, are on the service module. So the problem is, when it disconnected, it still had the same throttle mapping for all of those little thrusters as it did when it was connected. So in other words, to fly away, if it was to pitch or roll or yaw, it was thinking that it still was connected to the big thing, which means it would have probably just gone completely out of control and could have flown right back into the actual command module.
Wow, that's not good.
That's horrible. If it had flown back into the command module, first, you just never want two spacecraft coming in contact with each other, unless it's for a docking or berthing. And second off, it would really have likely, you know, could have damaged the heat shield.
Well, and how far back would, I mean, already did this issue set them back a little bit here? Obviously some, right?
Because we're in the point where we still don't even know how far back.
Right, and then imagine if they had actually done that and, like, collided and destroyed each other.
Right.
You know, meanwhile, DM1 is, like, just hanging, doing its thing, already been there, done that. You know, it would have been, it would have been a, why don't they just, it would have been like a, why are we even doing this anymore?
Right.
Like, you know.
So really, I mean, yeah, we don't really know what this means. And some of the interesting takeaways from the phone call was, you know, they're saying, yeah, we have a million lines of code, you know, and we have to check all of them, but we've only really run 66% of them. And the scary thing, I think it was Scott Manley pointed out, I think it was either on Twitter or something, but his takeaway was, and this is so true, he goes, this was totally the normal operation. Like, the trunk jettisoning and flying away, that is 100% in the normal mission. How did this not get noticed, right? Like, this isn't some off nominal, like, oh no, we had to jettison this thing and blah, 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 and abort from here, and it's, you know, a third Thursday from the month or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, it's not some weird thing. This is like, this was the mission.
Yeah.
And they still
missed. This is the easy thing you should have tested.
Yes. Like, how did that not get noticed? So it's really, and it's not, and I'm actually going to say, from my opinion, it's not just Boeing, but it's also a little bit NASA. NASA's supposed to be checking over all these. There's supposed to be this partnership where they're checking all their work.
I can add a little bit of color if just from developing software for a long time. The way you do it, you have automated tests of all these things. So the assuming they follow like best practices for software development, what in theory should be happening is you have tons and tons of test cases and an automated engine that will run through those test cases. And then, hey, I need to add this piece of code which does this one thing. I don't know, we strapped on a blender to it and we need a blender to work, whatever. I wrote the code for the blender. I add that to the code base, those million lines of code, and what will happen is I'll deploy that, and then all these checks, all the like thousands upon thousands of tests automatically kick off and send back what's going on. And so it's called regression testing. And so the basic idea is, oh, I made, like, because what the, like, prior to this way of doing it, the way software development would have major issues that seemingly came out of nowhere is you wrote the code for the blender or the dumb thing that is seemingly unrelated, completely unrelated from everything else, but it's actually not. And there's something else buried in those million lines of code that you just did one thing and it set off a catastrophic failure. But that's why we have now this regression testing where just you do one tiny change and boom, thousands of tests should run. That way you know if there's any, like if you accidentally caused an issue with any of those others. So it's not like you have to go through a million lines of code and test every line. Like this should all completely be automated. And I imagine NASA knows what they're doing here. So this shouldn't be, and you're at Boeing or whoever, like this all should be standard operations. It shouldn't be a weird thing that you have to figure out.
Yeah, it's just one of these things that does not instill confidence.
Yeah, right.
And it's like, the one parachute that didn't work during their abort test, sure, whatever, okay, you learned your lesson. Then the timer error, okay, you learned your lesson. Then the explosive bolts with the separation thing that we still don't really know that much about, you know, you're going to have to find a solution. There's so many things that are like, how long is it going to be before this thing's actually ready to fly with humans safely?
Yeah.
And the I don't know.
It does not instill confidence. You're right.
No, it brings up the whole point that basically Boeing's getting 60% more to do the exact same service for and quote something along the lines of we're going to leave no stone unturned and make sure this is like the safest spacecraft. This is at the beginning of all of this. They said that like you're hiring, you're paying 60% more because we're going to make sure that this is the best spacecraft we can build. You know, and all these no stone unturned. You know, absolute flight assurance and all this stuff. And we're seeing, quite frankly, we're seeing the opposite.
Well, and at some point, I mean, especially with, we'll just say, a presidential administration that is business-minded, profit is the thing you're looking at in business world. I don't think government actually should operate that way. But if you are thinking in those terms, very soon you have to come to the conclusion of this isn't worth it. And we need to find is if there are options, which I believe there are, then we just need to cut our losses and go. Like we have to move forward. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see more things like this happen, if they just cancel the whole thing, or you know, NASA says, "Hey guys, sorry, find another customer. Like we're not going with you. It's too expensive."
Well, here's the thing: is they already paid Boeing for this. And now the I think the big debate, or you know, paid a big amount. There's still I think another milestone probably before they actually start paying for the actual seats per se. I actually don't remember. Yeah. But the big thing is, if at least with this point, if they have to fly another OFT mission, which I'm sorry Boeing, but I think you're gonna have to fly another OFT mission, which will cost a lot of money. I think that should be at the cost of Boeing. That should absolutely be Boeing. I hope they don't talk NASA into it.
And Boeing, guess what? Doesn't have a lot of money right now because all the other parts of their business are also falling out of the sky.
And again, another reminder to everyone listening, at least for me, I have good friends that work at Boeing. So stuff like this isn't necessarily, like, don't, if you know someone that works at Boeing, don't just get on the internet and scream at Boeing all the time. But there does, something has to be figured out. Where is this management problem happening? Where is the, at what point in the chain, who is making the bad decisions, you know?
Yeah, with the whole airplane thing, the 737 MAX Air, the couple articles I read about it, that was essentially the crux of it. It wasn't that it was necessary, like, bugs are in software. That's just mm-hmm. how, because that's, there is no such thing as bug-free software.
Right.
So there has to be, you have to design a system in place that ensures whatever software does get released and is carrying people is as good as it can be and is guaranteed to work to, you know, whatever extent it's tested at. Well, the articles I read about it were kind of pointing to a cultural shift of, like, let's not test things as much to mm-hmm. make more money. Let's make sure we can get this out and sell more and make more money, because then guess what? That's maximizing shareholder value, which is what we do in this model. But guess who the biggest shareholder is? It's the guy saying maximize shareholder value. So it's saying, right. Hey, screw these people, make me more rich, is like the more crass way of putting it. But that right. culture being profit driven and bypassing some of these things, or creating a culture of, like, you know, you see something, you're like, maybe we should test that again. It's like, no, that costs money. Let's not test it again. You know,
right.
like
right.
that culture can lead to serious problems, as we've actually
like,
seen. So
we see this even in the way they're certifying their vehicle. They decided not to do an in-flight abort test with Starliner. Right.
So that's what I'm saying. Like, it's not necessarily yeah. the people doing the engineering or any of that. It seems like it's a more cultural kind of thing that right. is more, that is, you know, if history repeats itself, is most likely driven by the people on top that are just being greedy and trying to whatever. So, yeah, I think when all of us say this, like, it's not an engineer that sucks. It's like one dude or something, or one girl. It's like, no, it's more of a systemic issue from a lot of the reporting I've seen. So
yeah.
hopefully they can turn it around, because obviously they have a lot of value. They have a lot of smart people. They can do good things.
We will be staying on top of the Boeing Starliner stuff like we have been trying to this whole time. So hopefully, I'm starting to really, really lose hope in 2020 for humans being on Starliner, which is, at this point, I don't want them to rush it, obviously. I'd rather them not rush it, but it clearly seems like they haven't been rushing it. But yeah. So, but speaking of shareholder values, what is this I hear about?
Ooh.
Shareholder values with a certain company.
Well, let's go there. All right, let's bounce. Let's do a little ping pong here. So Tesla is just announced a $2 billion capital raise right after this. I'm reading a headline from Electrek. Right after yeah. Elon Musk said it doesn't make sense. Well,
yeah, yeah.
This is why I don't. You know, there's. In the moment, you can ask Elon something, and he'll give you his most honest answer always. That's what right. I think we all love about him.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that, like, reality won't set in a week later and go, hey, maybe actually we should look at that again, and he'll change his mind. I think that that's probably a good quality. But anyways, yeah, so Tesla announced that they have a new stock offering worth over $2 billion. This was after the stock jumped over $700 a share. And really, the deal is they're just trying to capitalize on that share price, essentially, is
right.
what's going on. So they're going to essentially sell, going to, like, out of the air, create 2.65 million new shares that will, you know, they'll sell them at the stock price that's there. Larry Ellison is going to buy some, who's a board member, founder of Oracle, if you guys are old tech dinosaurs like me. Elon is going to be buying some, et cetera. So they're expecting to raise between 2.01 and 2.31 billion when they actually execute this. And so yeah,
I don't quite, this always confuses me. Like, how can you, like, make more? What happens? Does it, are you dividing the pie more, or
so you're diluting the shares, which is not what investors like. So essentially, hey, we had 1 million shares, now we have 1.5 million shares. Like, so your actual share, like, if the stock price stays the same, then fine. But the stock price often goes down because essentially there's your portion got smaller, essentially, right, of the pie.
Right.
So, the stock did go down. It dropped, I think, by 4.5% immediately after the announcement, and then it's back. I think it's last I looked just a few minutes ago, it was like down 0.5% on the day.
So right now it's up 5%.
Well, there you go. Yeah. So
so it nulled itself out, or well, I don't get that.
If you look at it for, don't try to. Okay. Yeah. The stock market is not a thing that makes sense. Just flat, let's just agree. It's it doesn't make any sense. So, but with that, okay. So now this will. So they already have, I think it was $6.3 billion cash in the bank, which mm-hmm. means they're not going out of business anytime soon.
Right.
And add in $2 billion more to that, you got $8 billion there. It seems like they're just really trying to make use of this opportunity where the stock is so high. What they could, you know, typically when they've done this in the past, the reason was to build something. So, hey, we need to build out a new section of the Gigafactory or this or that, and we need $2 billion like right now to do that. Mm-hmm. And so investors would typically look at that as a positive thing. Here, because you're diluting existing shares, and the answer was to strengthen our balance sheet. There wasn't like a, oh, by the way, we're building this new thing. We need money for it. They have a lot of things they're building that they do need money for, but they've basically stated they're good. They already have enough money, and Elon has repeated over and over, they don't want to raise money for this. So it seems a little bit like they're just kind of being opportunistic here. But
maybe,
you know, it helps them grow in the future, but it's just not clear as to when or why.
I would love if they took this money and drew it straight into more superchargers, more
100% service centers.
Yeah, exactly. More service centers, period. Like triple down on it right now.
Yeah, because that actually has went down quite a bit. So, you know, people, and I just did a video on it, looking at it, and yeah, the supercharger network is still the biggest, best one out there from any one company. However, it like 3 years ago, they opened like in I think North America, like 3,000 new chargers. And then mm-hmm. 2 years ago, it was like 1,800. And then last year, it was like 1,100. So it's actually right. been declining. It's still a lot. Now, you won't need to continue to open, you know, gobs and gobs of them as you get more. Like, I'm in Arizona right now. I just did a road trip here. You know, the two places I stopped, I was the only car there for a whole hour. So you don't need like 50 more chargers there.
Right.
But anyways, yeah, I totally agree. Like, in fact, they could have just said that, I think. like there's no, like, holding their feet to the fire on that, right? Like, if they just said, yeah, we want to build out more service centers and more superchargers, I think investors would have looked at it and be like, oh, yeah,
right,
perfect. That makes a lot of sense.
Investors actually would have really liked that. I think they would have really liked hearing that.
And then they still could have done whatever they wanted to with the money. Mm-hmm. It's not like someone who said, okay, well, hey, so what happened to that money? Be like, I don't know. We built a bunch of them.
Right.
You know, it helped. Like, it's all wishy-washy at that point. It's just in a giant bank account. So.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. And what do you think about this all? Like, do you think this was a good idea? Do you?
I don't know. I mean, like, get while the getting's good, I guess, you know?
Yeah.
It's not a bad thing to do to add $2 more billion there. I mean, kind of global financial markets and things like that, there's been a lot of slowdowns. There's, you know, manufacturing slowdown in China. Like, if you look at the kind of broader economic picture, a lot of people predicting some sort of recession, some sort of downturn in the near future. Electric cars could take a hit from that. I mean, I think electric cars. So I don't think it's a bad move to kind of save up for a rainy day, and if you mm-hmm. have the opportunity and all that. But you know, it's to the average consumer, this probably means about nothing. Other than maybe we won't see those kind of like bubble-ish kind of stock jumps that we saw a couple weeks ago when it went to $900+ a share. So probably with more shares out there, you probably won't see that as much. But you know, who knows? We'll kind of follow it, of course. And for those that have invested in Tesla stock, that I think that this, you know, hopefully will yield better results for them. Now, a stock split would be something that would be really interesting that they could do. To essentially lower the price per share, Mm-hmm. But when you do a split, you would get double the shares.
Yeah.
So you don't lose any money. There's no dilution. But now, right. now more people can get into that market because it's a lower price.
Yeah. Yep. Which is why someone, I don't remember, is I think in my Discord channel or someone was comparing the stock price of one to a stock price of another. And I'm like, that's completely arbitrary because it matters. Yeah, the times that times the number of shares to really get the valuation of the company. Like
that's called market cap. You could just Google the market cap.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, so like, are you familiar with what Berkshire Hathaway is?
Yeah. With Warren B.
Warren Buffett. Yeah. Is he a Cornhusker? What is he? Is he a Nebraska?
He's Nebraskan, yeah. He lives in Omaha in like a $300,000 house or something.
Omaha. So he has lots of companies, but Berkshire had the main one, Class A stock, because they have, so there's also multiple classes of stock. I mean, this could go on like a long discussion, but anyways, the Class A stock, which is the preferred one. So if you have dividends, they're the people getting paid first. Class A stock of Berkshire Hathaway, to talk about that whole thing about the price, is currently one share is currently $340,948.66.
How
many? One share, $340,000 for one share.
Wow.
Yeah, it's nuts, right? And right. What's the volume here? So market cap is $555 billion for that. So, you know, and it's funny because I remember maybe 20 years ago, not 15 years ago, a friend of mine got married and his father-in-law gave them one share of Berkshire Hathaway stock, which at the time was worth like $80,000 or something like that, wow. Which was still nuts. And he bought it when it was a brand new company, when it was like, you know, $1,000 or $500 or something like that. So,
wow.
Yeah, so, that's nuts. But yeah, the price of the stock is not necessarily indicative of the overall.
It's pretty arbitrary.
Yeah, like if Tesla, so this is why you have stock buyback. So imagine if Elon bought back half of the stock out there. Well, then the price would go up for all the rest of it because it's now a more limited resource, right? So it's like, but there would be fewer of them. So net, it would be the same thing, but it would just be, you know, higher, whatever. Yeah, we're off in the weeds here. But they raised some money, and they're going to do some stuff with it.
Well, could they do some stuff with that, like make new battery cells or invest in new technologies or like...
Yeah, they could. And in fact, it looks like they're doing that. Tesla is now building a pilot battery cell manufacturing line at Fremont, which is the factory here in California, or I'm currently.
How do they have room for this?
It's probably outside in a tent,
or in the bathrooms.
REI had another sale, and so you know, they got themselves another tent. There's actually quite a bit of land there, but it's kind of just where, and it's kind of disjointed. It's not ideal. If you remember, we looked at it, I think last time with the Q4 and 2019 update letter, and they kind of showed Fremont and how things are, you know, have to go from this facility to this facility to this facility. And in China, it's like literally just like one loop. You know, they just come in one end and then go down and come back and then, but you know, ta-da, there's a car. Now they're starting to open this new line here, and they have some job postings for Tesla's cell manufacturing engineering group. They're looking for highly motivated equipment development engineers and, you know, to accelerate their next generation battery cell manufacturing program. So not a formal announcement, but there's a job posting announcing it, essentially.
Well, I wonder if we'll learn more about the stuff on Battery Day.
Hopefully, yeah, which is March or April, I forget. It's coming up.
Yeah.
Yeah, so lots of cool stuff coming there. And, you know, one of the things to think about here is that, you know, why would they be doing this? Why would they want to make their own battery cells? Well, in theory, they could make them better. They recently bought Maxwell Technologies, which had some interesting patents that they could maybe use. There's also this company, Hybar, which you know, specializes in the equipment to make battery cells. So they've kind of been assembling the Avengers here. And in addition to this, something that no one's really talked about but isn't even new news, is in Nevada, near the Gigafactory, a new lithium mine could be the biggest in North America. I believe is the biggest in North America. It could be one of the largest in the world. literally like 2 hours from the Gigafactory.
Whoa.
Yeah, and this news is from August of 2018. So this isn't even new at all, but no one's really talked about it or thought about it. I thought there were some funny quotes here talking about, you know, by 2025, the batteries will, you know, quadruple in demand. Like, yeah, I think it's happened a lot sooner than that. So imagine all these things coming together, right? It's kind of the confluence of them acquiring companies that are specialized in making battery cells, and then acquiring companies that have patents galore on like the, some of the most advanced actual chemistry and technology inside of the cell, and then having one of the world's largest battery factories within an hour or two's drive of the world's largest deposit of the materials for that factory.
Right.
Like, this could be, we could see Battery Day as being like, everyone else just being like, we're not worthy. We're not worthy, you know?
Yeah. It might be a total mic drop. When Elon said short burn of the century, I think he's right. Because I think he knows, obviously he knows all these things that they've been working on for maybe years or whatever. And just seeing all these things culminate, just going like, once these things all line up and all turn on and all these, you know, all these things are checked off, game over.
Yeah.
You know, and it really seems like this is what's exactly what's happening.
They've just been assembling the parts the whole time, and, you know. And the thing about it that's that is interesting is I still think that there has to be a bigger play here than just them making their own cars. I really think that they should produce things for other companies.
Right.
And they'll still crush. They still will, like, do amazing because what they make, others won't make. But, like, Honda could make a really dope, simple, tiny little, like, the Honda E, for example, that they're making, which, like, practically has, you know, old-school pump windows. You know, it doesn't have mechanical, but it's super cheap. But if the battery was cheap and good, that would solve the biggest problem for making cheap, affordable electric cars. So,
yeah.
You know, I just have to, I mean, I don't know. I don't know if the idea is be Apple, where, yes, you
have everything.
Right. And you have a minority stake as a single company in the overall smartphone market, but you get the majority of the profits because you have such, you know, they have like, what, 15% of market share of iPhones in the world versus iPhone and Android and whatever else is out there. However, because their phones are so expensive, that's a huge, huge profit source for them. So, I don't know. That would be a really interesting thing to hear Elon's, and I don't even know if he thinks that far ahead. I mean, he thinks like in wild terms, but I don't know if he, because that's like a very like business strategy kind of thing.
Right.
You know?
So the one thing I don't get is why would they do this in Fremont as opposed to their Gigafactory? When there's tons of room at the Gigafactory, and if you're, they're already producing and doing battery stuff there at Gigafactory, like, why would they, why?
Yeah.
I don't know. That's my big question.
Why wouldn't they?
Why wouldn't they just put one, like, do that out in the thing?
Yeah.
Why don't they just?
Now.
What?
We do have some questions. If you guys are new here, we have a segment called Why Don't They Just, where we encourage you guys to ask us these crazy questions that are seemingly obvious answers. And sometimes, you know, it's a good surprise. So do you want to start with the space one first or the Tesla one first? Because I've got two good ones here.
Let's start with space one. And this is a good one. So, and we should remind everyone, so we normally find these on Twitter. Joe normally is starting to read these now, and he's posting them. If yours doesn't get answered and it's getting a lot of likes, keep each week, please keep just like putting it back in there, because we're just going to keep looking for the best tweets and the one that you guys respond to most. So so don't give up if you don't see yours getting read. But we're going to do, so this one comes from Tyler at Tymel0822. Obviously, SpaceX is going to need to land uncrewed starships on Mars to practice. With everyone worried about the radiation on Mars, why don't they just send large amounts of lead or radiation shielding as mass sims while testing? Lead would survive a crash to be salvaged. So basically, why wouldn't they just, you know, if they have to have mass simulators and things, why wouldn't you just, you know, send some radiation shielding type of stuff
just like launch cargo ships full of it and be like, yeah, whatever, it'll land somewhere.
And even if it crash lands, like you can still salvage the raw lead and develop, you know, lead shielding for your habitats and stuff like that.
Because if you did that, let's say you had like a shipping container size thing full of lead and just crashed it into the Martian surface, it would crack open the layer of the crust and reveal the alien world underneath it.
You basically shot a bullet at it.
So I'd be very careful about doing this. And in fact, they know that. They're keeping it from us. That's why they haven't done it.
That's exactly why they haven't done it.
There you go. Answered.
Answers with Ben. So I think for me, that's reasonable. But I think, honestly, they would want to send more valuable things to Mars on the first couple that, you know, the whole radiation thing being horrifying and things like that. I think the answer to that is getting underground, or, you know, it's just not quite as bad as everyone thinks. I'm pretty sure I saw that a 2-year trip to Mars with minimal shielding is not that different than smoking a pack a day. And while that's not, listen, I know that's not bad. Listen, that's.
For how long? For 2 years?
Well, like a pack a day? Yeah, I guess.
Come on.
I mean, realistically, people do that now.
Well, fine. Yeah, and people die from it.
And people die from it, exactly. But, like, it's not like it's like.
So you're saying astronauts have a death wish, which is
not
probably
death,
not
but if
that
you're
far
willing
off.
To be the first person to explore a new world ever, 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 and you're standing next to someone that literally does smoke a pack a day, and they've survived to be 85, like, and you could go explore a new thing, like, it's not that bad. Like, it's not like you will die. It's just that it greatly increases your risk of cancer from the radiation.
Do we know if the materials he suggested there actually would solve this?
Yeah. Yeah, you just need radiation shielding. You need
But like
need
a
shielding.
Ton of it. Like an epic ton of it, right? Because if you have a lot of people there.
Well, I mean, we're talking about at first just protecting your crew. You know, so you'd need enough for your habitat, basically. And
didn't
you know, you
Andy
can use other
Weir
things.
Talk about
you can
this?
Use Yeah, he did. Kind of.
And they said water, wasn't it?
Yep, you can use water, you can use fuel, you can use dirt, you can use lead, you can use almost anything that will scatter the radiation or absorb it, you know. And I think the thing that I'm guessing Tesla or SpaceX would do is actually just send a boring machine with them.
Oh.
And literally just bore down a couple a little bit into Mars and develop habitats under the surface.
That's not a bad idea. Now, boring machines are incredibly heavy, but how heavy are they compared to 60 Starlink satellites?
Right. Well, and now you're talking Starship, which Starship can land about 100 tons to the surface of Mars. And I'm guessing that it could easily land a boring machine. So
and
I think
that
it'd
thing
be better.
You could just send direct. You doesn't need it. Just turn it on in space, have it going, right? Get some ludicrous mode
Ben.
On it and just like smash it directly in.
Yes, Ben.
It'll go
you
all the way through.
Still a child at heart. Keep it. Please keep it.
Yes.
But so my answer to that would be, why send something that might be useful when you could, and if you think it has like a high probability of failure, as opposed to sending something that actually is useful, period, I'd rather bet on that side of things, personally. I'd rather see like a boring machine go and some proper habitat material than just like a hunk of lead.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Fair enough. Now we have another Why Don't They Just here that didn't get as many likes, but I wanted to call out because I've been yammering about this forever. The Tesla App Store. So this is Death's Keeper. Cool little icon there, by the way. Why don't they just launch a Tesla App Store already? Everyone wants it. Why not just implement it? Another income source is never a bad thing. So, Tim, what say you?
Why? That's the biggest why don't they just?
Yeah.
Period. That is to me the I think we should just do that every week. Why don't they just launch the App Store? Why don't they just launch the App Store? Why don't you just, like, come on. To me, that's.
Well,
the
there is some things to consider here, I would say. And Elon has had a point, I would say. I would disagree, or I would say his point is losing its strength over time as Tesla delivers more and more cars. So if you recall, Elon, so I actually got to ask him this on a press call.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, they were like, we're focused on these things. Make sure only to ask about these things. And I'm like, cool. How about this thing?
Right.
That I've just been dying to ask you forever.
Right.
And he answered it. And he said his thinking, his point was that without millions and millions of people using it, it wouldn't be profitable. It wouldn't be valuable. And he's thinking tens of millions, I think is what he said. Now, I think that's a bit overblown. The thing that, you know, so there is stuff that they would have to do. It's not like you just go, you know, to a website and say, okay, let me download a new app store platform. Like, no. You have to write code. You have to have APIs. You have to have approval mechanisms. You have to have data security. You're talking about installing software on a car. So now, despite the people don't really know this and it's not obvious, but the system that actually drives the car and the system that plays music and things are totally separate. So those things not being connected, there's the risk of like it, you know, affecting your car
hacked.
Is low, but you know, they are in the same, I mean, there may be a way, but whatever. So it is something to consider, but what about like just data security and user privacy? Like there's a lot of things to consider.
Right.
You know, back
it's
in the early days, back in the early days of, let's say, the internet, when it was like, you know, we didn't have this concept of like an app could just be stealing your data. You know, we didn't care. Life was easy in terms of building these things. But now that we're in that world, we have to really put a lot of thought and care of like how things get approved, what types of apps are allowed. So it's not without, you know, any effort. But probably a team of five people could figure it out in a month or two. So it's not trivial, but it's not like, you know, landing Starship on Mars. So it's somewhere between those two. The question is, would you make money on it? And I don't think the way to evaluate that would be to look at app sales, which, you know, it's funny because even today, like iPhone users and Android users have a completely different perspective on this, where it's like, as an Android user, if it costs 99 cents, I'm pissed. I'm like, why does this cost money? And like every app on the App Store costs money practically, right?
Mm-hmm.
So anyways, so I think like making money off the sale of apps is not the way to look at it. It's that the features your car has would exponential, like overnight, just boom, like a tremendous value. So now it really would make every other car look completely stupid.
Yes.
Because Tesla can,
they could spend less time engineering it themselves. If it's being crowdsourced and people, I'd pay $50 to make it so like, move my face, the mirrors move with it or something, you know, like, I don't know.
My thing is like, I want a better navigation app, right? And one that, in fact, I just want Google Maps. Now, I know Google Maps are integrated, but I hit navigate, it finds the route, and then I want search on the way.
Right,
so
like waypoints and all that, yeah.
Right, waypoints. I want all, and guess what? This is already exists in Google Maps, so it's not like there would be much. They would have to port it over resolution. There would be some work to be done, but the core technology that Google Maps offers could just like basically be ported over in a week by some Google engineers. So yeah, and then Tesla wouldn't have to really do anything to that. And in fact, the apps you have now, the new ones, Twitch streaming, Netflix, YouTube, those were developed by Netflix and Google or YouTube and everybody. So, because I have friends at these companies and I asked them, I'm like, yo, Netflix in particular, I said, how did you guys do this? Did they just make it without you? They're like, no, we did it for them. And they gave us like, they didn't have like really well-polished like API documentation and stuff. So they kind of had to do back and forth. But Netflix developed that app. So they're kind of going this route already. They're just doing it very selectively.
Right. Huh. Yeah. There you go. That's a heck of a why don't they just.
That's a let's just.
Let's just.
Very much just.
Yeah.
Do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Changing topics really quick. I feel like we should, I should go back really quick to the, remember when we were talking about the budget and for some reason, why don't they just, going back to another why don't they just, we've talked a long time about why don't they just use like Falcon Heavy or a Delta IV Heavy instead of SLS when SLS is like, you know, 10 times more expensive. One of the things they actually talked about in that budget, I forgot to mention this is big. So the whole part of this budget was basically, it was pointed out in this, that they could save $1.5 billion if they went with a commercial rocket instead of SLS for the Europa Clipper mission. And Europa Clipper is a mission that's going to go to Europa, hopefully have a lander on it and probe down and do all these cool
really?
Things on Europa. Yeah.
That's awesome.
A huge flagship mission, like massive, amazing mission, you know, over $1 billion mission, so a huge one. And it was originally going, it was congressionally mandated to fly on SLS. And this is an interesting topic because there's a few things that you have to take into consideration because you think, why on earth would you spend $2 billion to fly it out there when it could physically be flown on Falcon Heavy or Delta IV Heavy?
Right.
The difference is that SLS can get it in 2 years directly. It can just shoot it straight out there. It has enough power to do it all the way out there. And then the Delta IV Heavy and a Falcon 9 or Falcon Delta IV Heavy and Falcon Heavy, they have to do this like multiple slingshot maneuvers and stuff. So what happens, and this is some good documentation. I was really excited to learn about this. So if you use, say, Delta IV Heavy, it doesn't quite have enough power, including with a kick stage. It would have to go down and do Venus assist to get itself out to Jupiter. So it'd take like 7 years. The problem is now you have to put the spacecraft closer to the sun. It'll experience more heating. You add more
radiation,
weight. You add more all these different things because you're now getting it closer to the sun. So the mission profile changes quite a bit. So it's actually pretty hard. Falcon Heavy, if you do a fully expendable Falcon Heavy, no recovery at all, which would still be a third the price of Delta IV Heavy even, you can do just one Earth assist and sling it out there. So it would still take a long time. I think that'd probably still be a 7-year mission too, but it would offer a huge cost savings. But the other thing people need to remember that's not easy to think about is 5 years of coasting isn't free. It's not free. You still have to pay mission managers. You have to still pay people to be checking out of the spacecraft. You know, and think about hiring, let's just say, 5 people for 5 years that all get paid $100,000.
Yeah.
You know, that's not cheap, you know? But then again, that's still way cheaper than $1.5 billion. So.
So is Europa the one that we think there might be life on?
It's a pretty good candidate because it definitely has liquid water underneath its icy crust.
Got it. And then Titan is another one that we would potentially be able to live on. Is that right?
In a way, yes, because it has, it's really cold, but it has a nice thick atmosphere, a very thick atmosphere.
So the radiation protection is there and all that.
It's actually, it's really cold. Like
you'd have to go underground and build some kind of heated.
You'd have to I don't even know how you'd actually survive on the surface, but because it's like, it'd be like you're walking around where there's lakes of liquid methane.
Oh yeah.
You know, methane is your liquid, you know?
Yeah.
So
well, you can
you're talking
it.
Like you could burn it and it'd be easy to refuel a starship, but like, imagine just going out to the beach and dipping a toe in liquid methane. I mean, you're not going to be too happy there.
No.
Yeah. So I just thought we definitely needed to talk about that. But, it's almost as if NASA's made some big changes and as if some of those big changes were taken over to SpaceX.
Oh.
How about that for a transition?
Just pronounce this guy's last name for me, please.
Gerstenmaier.
Fine.
So Bill Gerstenmaier, or William Gerstenmaier, Bill Gerstenmaier.
William.
This is really exciting, actually. So he was basically the director. What was he? The associate administrator of human spaceflight or something? Let me see.
Human exploration and operations.
Yeah, and this man has been on just about every really important program at NASA, and was a really, really, really just rave reviews of the man. Everyone said that, you know, he's a really sound advice, and when he says something, it's well thought out, well executed. He actually got fired, I believe, in July after a congressional hearing about basically the Artemis program. And he was just kind of saying like, there's almost no way we can get there in 2024 without a huge increase in budget. And there's still a lot of huge technical challenges. He's just being realistic. And in a move that was very confusing to literally everyone, Jim Bridenstine let him go after that, like immediately.
Well, do you remember the old commercial? It was, It was a joke, but for someone like me at the time working in corporate America, it was very close to home. There was a bunch of monkeys in a room in suits, and they're all screaming, throwing bananas and stuff. And they had a chart there, and it was like going up, and they're all like partying, doing all this. And then like a guy walks in, like a human walks in, and he's like, hey, no, no. And like they flip the chart up, and it's going the opposite way. And then they get all pissed, and like, ah, and they like kick him out of the room, and then they flip it back over.
And then they go back to partying.
That's totally real. No, I mean, that's like, hey, yeah. Guys, we're actually, we need like triple, you know, we really spent time analyzing the numbers. It's not going to happen within what we thought, blah, blah, blah. And the answer isn't, okay, well, let's dive in and figure it out. The answer is out, you.
Yeah, get him out of here. Yeah.
And bring in the guy that says we can do it, and yeah. Even though it'll never happen, you know, it's like.
Right, right. I mean, some of that's a good thing. I think some of that, you know, if you have someone that's like, we can do this, you know, I think Elon Musk would be the epitome of, we can do it. I mean,
yeah, but no one's going to fire Elon.
Right, right. But what happened here is, so since then, you know, NASA had a stand-in associate administrator of human spaceflight, and then they replaced him with a more permanent one. Now, I can't remember his name. I'm failing to remember who the current one is. But he was on that teleconference with Starliner. Anyway, so Bill Gershenmeyer was out there kind of looking for a new job, and he officially, it's coming out that he officially got swooped up, or at least is doing some consulting for SpaceX. And this is really, really, really good because he's intimately knowledgeable about the Dragon capsule, about the Falcon 9, about their certification program, about how NASA certifies things. He's a very conservative and cautious voice at a time when I think that's absolutely vital. When, you know, we're seeing failures from Boeing. SpaceX had, you know, a Dragon capsule blow up, you know, 8 months ago or whatever, 10 months ago. And for someone like him to be on the crew at SpaceX, just to have that really voice of authority and double checking all the work, and he's working directly under Hans Koenigsmann, I think this is huge. And I think this is a really good hire because SpaceX is so good at pushing the boundaries and fast forwarding and getting to the next step in a hurry. Having someone like this that is just totally honed in to all of the actual intricacies and all of the details. I remember he was at the DM1 press conference and I asked him about certification of the grid fins and things like that. And if that was going to change anything after they failed on that one mission. And Gerstenmaier actually had some good things to say and feedback in response to that. So he knows his stuff. He really, really knows his stuff. And it's really cool to see him actually on the team at SpaceX now.
And the mustache love that he brings here is just epic. I mean, this guy's got it going on right here. This is like some 70s action that we have. So, you know, SpaceX definitely needs to know what a real mustache looks like, and they now do. So, good job to Jim here.
It's true. It's to Bill. It's true. That's a mighty, mighty mustache.
That's what a man looks like. Okay, guys? That's...
Yeah, none of this scruff that we have.
Yeah, yeah, none of this boys. Little hipster nonsense that us children have going on. That's what a real man's face should be.
It's true. Okay, so one more thing about SpaceX that I wanted to talk about. This just kind of blew my mind, honestly. We're getting more pictures from Boca Chica Gal, from Mary down there with NASA spaceflight. She posted some pictures, but there's two things that blew my mind. Just looking through her thread, you can see what these are. And also South Padre Island, my friends Gene and Rachel have been posting some more things too. What's crazy though is we're seeing Starship get built, and go down a little bit more. This is kind of the thing that blew my mind. I know that they've been building a new building, and it's kind of their new vehicle assembly building, but go down a little more. We'll see just how big this new building is. One more, I think. Because it just keeps going. It just keeps getting taller and taller. Where is that? Maybe it's near the top. I don't know. But anyway, there it is, right there. So I thought for sure like four segments. There's a picture here. It's a video of cranes building this new vehicle assembly building. And it's very much a vertical assembly building. And at one point, it was only two sections. All of a sudden, overnight, it became four sections. Now they're adding a fifth section. people are starting to go, they could actually build super heavy in here. Maybe. Or that it's getting up to that height where they could build the whole super heavy booster. Or that they perhaps are...
Why would they build it vertically, though? Is that easier, or...?
I think for the way they're doing these welds and those rings, mm-hmm. it makes sense to stack them vertically. And, yeah, it's hard to say how they'll actually get it from there out to the pad.
Yeah, because you have to, like, lay it down, right? And then...
Or do, like, a crawler. Maybe they'll buy one of the crawlers from NASA. You know, the old... That'd actually be pretty
like
cool
the space if they bought that old... one?
Yeah, space shuttle and Saturn V crawlers. Because I believe there's two or three out at NASA, and they've been upgraded and retrofitted, but it'd be awesome. Well, maybe SpaceX would just make something out of Tesla parts. Let's be honest. You know, it'd be four Model X's or four Cybertrucks.
Yeah. Pushing and pulling.
Yep, exactly. But it just keeps coming together, and I just wanted to give a quick little update here since this is moving so fast. That the ring sections, people are starting to piece it together. It's looking like this thing is just coming together so freaking quick. If you pull up, I didn't really mean to talk about this on the show, but I noticed Elon had responded to me really quick before the show. Pull up Elon's thing. So Dr. Robert Zubrin went out to Boca Chica, I guess, and had a conversation with Elon. And one of the takeaways that he talked about, and I need to listen to the podcast because I just read a thing saying that one of the takeaways, he mentioned in there that you could return from low Earth orbit without a heat shield. And then, so I was like, that doesn't quite sound right. And I said, so I asked, you know, is that it technically could, or that it will fly to Leo without a heat shield. And basically Elon came back saying, unfortunately, Starship unlikely to survive Leo entirely intact without shielding on windward side, but none required on leeward side. Even windward shielding is very light. So we've been hearing that already, you know, that's kind of been what he's been saying. So hearing from someone that had talked to him that said he wouldn't need any was a big shock and didn't sound right to me. So we're still likely, maybe for the 20-kilometer hop, we won't see any heat shielding yet, just because why risk it, you know, why add all that for just the up and down.
What's the Carmine, 100 kilometers, right?
100 kilometers. And even if you came suborbital from 100 kilometers, you know, did 100 kilometer up and down.
You're not out of the heating atmosphere, technically.
The heating... Oh, yeah. You're way out of the atmosphere.
Oh, okay.
You're way out of the troposphere and the stratosphere. But the problem is you're just not going nearly fast enough to generate the same type of heat.
Got it. Right.
So even if it went straight up and straight back down and crossed the Carmine, the
like
heating
in
is...
water, you just came, breached the surface and came back down. You didn't
exactly.
jump 50 feet out and... Yeah, gotcha.
Or it'd be like jumping up, yeah, like a 50 feet up and jumping straight back down versus going 4,000 miles an hour on a boat
and then
jumping straight up 50 feet and jumping straight back down. You know, like it's the velocity is, you know, they always say it's basically velocity cubed is how hot you get. So if you increase your entry by, you know, double times, it actually goes up 8 times for heating is how much. So when you start speeding things up, a lot of things change. So if you're hitting the atmosphere at, say, I don't know, 1,000 kilometers versus 26,000
kilometers.
Did
they drop the whole, like, methane ventilation thing happening?
Transpirational cooling?
Yeah.
That has not come up in a long time. And I'll ask Elon about
See,
that. And,
memory and here. It's not completely
That's good.
Gone.
That's good. Well, it's a cool thing. You know, the transpirational cooling is a really cool thing, and I'd never really heard of anyone doing that recently. I mean, it was done on some old warheads, and it's done on, like, the leading edges of airplane wings sometimes to de-ice them. But, yeah, there was some talk at some point that they would maybe do that on some hot spots. I still wouldn't be surprised if they'd maybe do that in between, like, hinges. You know, where you have these moving parts where a traditional heat shield would risk having, you know, plasma enter into those hinges where they might not need to wick it away, you know, because the whole thing with, you're basically creating a boundary layer when you bleed methane out. And just like how, have you ever seen those things where, like, you have
fire,
a stove?
It would look like a giant fireball.
It would definitely look like a giant fireball. It's going to look like a giant fireball anyway. But what, have you ever seen, like, when you have a stove and, like, a droplet of water, and sometimes it'll stay entirely intact on top of this, on top of, like, a hot surface?
It's just bouncing around,
Yeah, because there's this boundary layer there. It's the same type of thing with methane or with anything, with any cool liquid, you can create this boundary layer so the heat doesn't actually come in contact with the surface. It just creates this layer and you just bleed it off. You just keep it flowing. And then it would probably not light until substantially later, actually.
Yeah.
It probably wouldn't, you know, probably wouldn't go kaboomy or turn ignite until well
you're
after
just going way too fast for that to that chemical reaction to occur at that
and
speed.
You're high enough that I don't know how much oxygen it would take to actually
got
you know because it is plasma hitting it. I don't know much about
yeah,
that
the
but,
pressure of it, the atmosphere, it's a whole yeah, weird that's
it's a whole weird thing.
I'm still blown away by the whole confusing thing how water kind of acts differently than other liquids when it freezes. It like expands and then
yeah,
contracts here
right,
on at 1G or whatever atmosphere, however many bars we have here.
Yep, one bar.
And then, but on Mars, it has the triple point thing. Do you know about that?
Yeah, what is that again?
So the reason water boils and the reason the molecules act the way they do here is because of the atmosphere that we have, the pressure. So if you were to try to, like, say, boil water on the top of Mount Everest or something, or somewhere where there's less atmosphere, the actual temperature it needs to get to boil is less because there's not as much pressure for that reaction to occur. So if you go to, say, Mars, it actually has what's known as a triple point where it can be a solid,
oh,
frozen,
yeah,
a liquid, and a gas at the exact same time because
wow,
of the temperature and atmosphere, just how different it is than here on Earth. It's like it's a really weird mind thing that doesn't make sense, you know. But
yeah,
like dry
yeah,
ice is an example where it's a solid but it's also a gas,
right?
And it, you know, it's a
and it
yeah,
doesn't go to liquid, yeah,
exactly, yeah. So there's like the just kind of weird stuff that happens with different amounts of pressure and atmosphere and water specifically.
Crazy. And Greg Malia in our Discord says sublimation is that the transition of substance directly from solid to gas phase without passing through the intermediate
okay,
liquid phase.
Yeah,
that's
so
right,
that's dry ice doing that, right?
Yep.
Yeah, so anyways,
crazy,
it's just a weird thing. So that's, yeah, so obviously, so getting back to the why, you know, if it's coming down and methane's shooting off, what we're used to methane doing here would be different, not only because of not having oxygen or other gases to interact with, but also the pressure of
yeah,
that of not having an atmosphere or whatever would be different.
Yep.
So who knows what would happen?
That's so,
somebody
yeah,
knows,
all that stuff. It's crazy. So we'll see. I'll try to ping Elon more about transpirational cooling if it's dead or whatever, and we'll see if we can get an answer. But,
it would look cool.
I still think it'd look cool. I still think it'd look really cool. And he mentioned one point about it maybe being in hot spots, but I'm guessing they'll find out and just kind of figure out, you know, once. Fly it, see where it's hot, see what almost fails, you know, and beef those areas up as SpaceX or unbeef up parts, you know, over beef it at first.
Right.
And then just start, you know, thinning and doing some other things to make it, you know, as efficient as possible is kind of SpaceX's approach. Iterate. Iterative.
Continuous
yeah,
improvement.
So, continuous improvement. So what are you working on? I know that you're in Arizona. Are you cranking on a video right now?
I've got a couple. So the next video coming out is what I recommend as the best Tesla you can currently buy. So of all the ones that are not like Cybertruck or whatever, but like ones that are available for sale now that you will get now that are actually on the road, what is the best one and which one would I recommend? So just kind of going through. I think I'm going to do that every maybe 6 months as new ones come out just to be like,
yeah,
hey, you know.
Wait, the best electric truck, is that what you said?
The best Tesla you
What'd
can
you
buy.
What'd you say?
Every six
oh, the best
months.
Tesla. Oh,
every six
for
months,
some reason it was like,
I'm going to do
okay,
it.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah
there's been some weird stuff happening. Like this company, Nikola. Nikola?
Yeah.
Say that right?
Yeah.
Nikola? I don't know. Nikola. They came out with a new 600-mile plug-in hybrid truck. But they came out with it as in, like, they have a rendering of it.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
I'm just looking at it going, I mean, it's like Mercedes came out with this Avatar car, right? Cool.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
like it's at that level of kind of, like, vaporness of just like,
yeah,
oh, yeah, I hired some guy on Fiverr. We drew it up and give me money.
Like, ready to go. Yep,
so
we've got it all
done. So I don't
done,
really know. Like, it seems kind of ridiculous, but yeah, the electric trucks are still, like, the only one really worth thinking about, I think, that we don't know about yet is the electric F-150. That's going to be the one to watch for sure, which I don't know if we'll see it this year. It might be next year, but it's coming for sure.
Yep. Very cool.
What about
very
you? Cool. What's going on?
Oh, there's a stream. There's a launch tonight. There's a launch Saturday that I'm going to that I'm going to shoot and try to live stream.
Florida.
And I'm, down in Florida. And then hopefully I'm working on getting permission to be able to shoot the actual rocket pollution video at Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex.
Oh, cool.
At the actual, thing. If not, and at the Rocket Garden. If I can't do it there, I might hold off until I'll be going to NASA's Kennedy's, the actual like press site for CRS-20. And maybe it'd be cool to do it there, you know. Just I'd like to do it somewhere cool.
Yeah. You know, the Rocket Garden.
You know, talking about rocket pollution.
I had a funny, it took me a while to realize that those weren't the real ones.
The most part.
Right. Well, because they don't come back, right?
Right.
But it took me a while because I go up to L.A., and charge my car, and there's an actual Falcon 9 that's been to space and came back.
Yeah, and came back. Yeah, so, that is.
So
yeah, you're right.
My perspective is when I see a rocket here that's like to look at, it actually has like, been.
Oh, what cool mission have these ones done?
Yeah, and then I'm like,
oh wait,
this isn't a real, or maybe it is real, but it's not. You know,
that's actually most of them aren't even real rockets.
Right, it's just a replica.
Of them are just replicas. Yep.
Yeah.
And I think there's only a few actual pieces of hardware in the rocket garden, but most of the rockets are just tubes to look like it, you know?
Yeah,
fuselage or something, yeah.
Yeah. They don't really make it back intact anymore.
Well, definitely not. And the ones that are like, were left over inventory probably got scrapped and stuff, a lot of that.
Yeah, like
stuff,
they have, so. I think at the, what's it called? California Science Center, where is it Discovery mm-hmm. is?
Yep.
Or the Endeavor. The Endeavor's at Kennedy Space Center.
No, that's Atlantis.
Oh, okay.
Discovery. It's Endeavor. Endeavor's in California.
Okay.
Discovery.
But
outside
they
DC.
Have like the fuel tanks, but they're not really the fuel tanks. They're just like they made these.
They would have been.
Oh,
that
they are.
One
would have
been
over.
That one would have been. Yes.
Okay.
That one's actually a real would have been a flight hardware.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or some kind of test hardware or something. But it is like legit flight hardware.
Got it. Okay.
Flightable.
Because we saw that and we were like, what's going on here? And they said that they're going to actually take the shuttle there and mount it up there.
Yes.
Which they were kind of highlighting of like, well, so what that means is like this super up close thing where you can almost touch it, you're not going to get that anymore, right?
Not
like
at
you're not going to get an up close, unless they build maybe a structure around it you can walk up and down.
They are. It's going to be really cool, actually. They'll have like these, you'll climb like stories in elevators and actually poke. It's going to be insane because they're stacking the whole space shuttle vertically.
So as you'll, if it were...
I mean, that's huge. It's huge. It'll be like over, you know, 250 feet tall or something, or 300, however tall the tip of the tank is. That's a 30-story building to go around this thing. That's not, you know,
right next to the Colosseum too.
It's gonna be crazy.
And shout out to you know, all those people with the taxes paying for this out here in California, because it's cost us a whopping $3 to get in and see that when we went. Whereas when we went to Kennedy Space Center, it was like $60 for every person, including a 2-year-old. So I was very upset about like, well, he's not even going to, he doesn't even know what's happening.
Right. Yeah, I hear you. So
anyways.
Stay tuned. We got a lot more footage and stuff and things coming out, so. Yeah, I'm working on a lot of things in the back end on my whole thing.
Yeah,
so a lot
I'm excited,
of things will be
man. You're good
will
at
be
that,
ready, so Yeah, dude. All right. Oh, and we should mention too, Joe is not feeling the best. So everyone, if you made it this far in the podcast, wish him a quick recovery and hope he just starts feeling better. So
yeah, send him whiskey if you know where he lives. Just bring bottles. That'll help.
It definitely always. All right, that'll do it. We'll see you in our ludicrous future.
Hey, thanks so much for listening. If you like what we do and you want to kind of help get it out there, you can give us a nice review on any of your podcast streaming platforms, whichever one you use. That kind of helps get it out there. Also, we do have a Patreon set up, so you can join us there at patreon.com/ourludicrousfuture. You can get your name in the credits, meet a whole other group of like-minded people. It's a lot of fun. We do appreciate it. We'll see you there. Thanks.